From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the WABE studios in Atlanta, Georgia. As you know, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We hope you know that. We always want you to know that. We don't take you for granted in any way. We're very grateful for your support. Today, as so many public conversations have been reduced to people screaming fake at each other, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, July 23rd is celebrated by Zoroastrians as Kardad Sal, birth of Prophet Zarathustra, and Monday is the Mormon Pioneer Day. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, the Supreme Court snipped away at the Trump Muslim travel ban by declaring grandparents to be close relatives for the purpose of entering the United States. An unprecedented African-American clergy advocacy day on Capitol Hill to protest federal budget cuts proposed by the Trump administration led to a number of arrests on Tuesday. A week earlier, a diverse group of faith leaders faced arrest as they stood up to oppose the anticipated assassination of Obamacare. And this coming week is critical in the push to finish a film documenting the groundbreaking Nuns on the Bus social justice campaigns headed up by our good friend Sister Simone Campbell. Nuns on the Bus, the movie, is the result of Sundance award-winning filmmaker Melissa Reagan following the sisters from the very first bus tour in 2012. Find out how you can help make sure this film gets completed at stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us.
How is it possible that words like those, months and years of words like those, do nothing to alienate purportedly moral, Jesus-inspired political Christian conservatives in this country? How is it possible that an angry, divisive campaign that didn't end with the election continues to hold self-described values voters in thrall? Well, that's not a question I can answer, except around the margins. The place where earnest people of faith experience the excruciating realization that their beloved faith is being perverted into a political weapon and nothing more. Having gone through this horrible process myself back in the 1970s, I deeply feel their pain. And I was moved to read the words of my friend, the Reverend Dr. Brett Younger, in a heart-rending column headlined, "Donald Trump Stole My Old Church." I look forward to welcoming Dr. Younger on this week's State of Belief.
Once you ask Congress to direct the Department of Defense to single out and scrutinize one religion to the exclusion of others, you're basically promoting anti-Muslim sentiment, and it has real-life consequences on the ground. Plus, I believe it's unconstitutional.
The so-called Franks Amendment, a proposal to put Muslims and Muslim leaders in this country under the microscope to study adherents of this faith and only this faith in a misguided and counterproductive search for violent extremists and dangerous rhetoric, was almost a perfect model of how we don't do things in this country. Thankfully, enough lawmakers felt a line had been crossed that the amendment was defeated, at least for now. But this and other such initiatives are a grave and ongoing cause for concern for advocates of American values and true religious freedom, and we'll get a briefing from Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. But first,
since the 1950s, churches have had really a chill put on them, fearing that the IRS was going to come in and shut them down if they did anything that was deemed political.
It's a crucial piece of policy that prevents even more of the terrible trend we're already suffering from. Political religious right forces driving the narrative on Capitol Hill, ensuring the national debate happens on their terms in a way that leaves most Americans feeling like Alice through the looking glass. I'm talking about the Johnson Amendment, which equips the IRS to challenge tax-exempt organizations that pervert their mandate into electoral advocacy. In today's anything-goes atmosphere, this may seem like a quaint issue to concern ourselves with. But on the other hand, I think recent months have shown us that things can always go far worse than even pessimistic predictions allow for. Now, with that in mind, an urgent campaign from the Essential Secular Coalition for America is designed to highlight a specific attack on the Johnson Amendment, and I am very pleased to welcome Senior Legislative Associate Sarah Levin back to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, thank you for being with us again.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why is defending the Johnson Amendment such a priority for the Secular Coalition?
First of all, we're concerned about the implications of repealing or weakening the Johnson Amendment on a constitutional basis and the First Amendment basis. The most recent attack on the Johnson Amendment is Section 116 of the 2018 Financial Services and General Government Appropriations Bill. It adds a bunch of hoops to jump through that make it next to impossible for the IRS to enforce the Johnson Amendment, but specifically for churches. So what that does is it raises the constitutional issue of why should the government only selectively enforce a rule that applies to all 501c3 nonprofits that are benefiting from these great tax benefits of, you know, they collect tax-deductible donations and they're tax-exempt, and only enforcing that rule for all nonprofits but religious ones, which is an Establishment Clause issue. So that's that's one reason, but there are many other reasons to be concerned about this. I know that we've been working very closely with our faith allies, like the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty and the Interfaith Alliance as well, where they're concerned, of course, about churches being targeted. It's really easy right now to say, nope, sorry, council member, sorry, senator, sorry, whoever the candidate is, we can't endorse you because it's against the law. Well, it's going to be very difficult to say no when there's not that legal cover if all of a sudden that window is opened up. And I know a lot of people of faith are concerned about their kind of sacred places of worship being politicized. And then the broader problem, of course, is how this impacts the nonprofit sector. Americans really trust nonprofits to do good work, but there's different versions of attacks on the Johnson Amendment right now. There's that Section 116 I mentioned, but then there's also the Free Speech Fairness Act as well. And so that this could come out a number of ways, but at the end of the day, probably our top concern at the Secular Coalition is it has to do with the Form 990. So a lot of people don't know that the only nonprofits, 501c3 nonprofits, that don't have to file financial disclosure forms like everybody else does, this is, it's called the Form 990, is houses of worship. So as of now, there's no way to kind of hold houses of worship accountable to their tax-exempt status. Now, if you add on top of that, making it either completely impossible to enforce the Johnson Amendment or repealing the Johnson Amendment altogether, what's going to happen is all of a sudden these houses of worship that don't file the Form 990 can also endorse or oppose candidates. And what's that going to do? It's going to open a new hole for dark money to flow through houses of worship. And remember, anybody could just go ahead and say, oh, yeah, I'll start a church, wink, wink. But it's really not a church. It'll become a really easy way to kind of flow money to and from candidates, which, of course, is going to compromise the integrity of nonprofits generally. It'll compromise the integrity of houses of worship that are not participating in that kind of work. And we're concerned from a constitutional basis on the separation of church and state, of keeping government out of religion and religion out of government.
Now, Sarah, what's interesting, in survey after survey, people of faith and faith leaders, large majorities of these groups say they don't want houses of worship to become repositories of dark money. So who do you think does want this change?
You're absolutely right. The majority of people of faith across denominations, as well as faith leaders, including evangelical leaders, do not want the Johnson Amendment to be touched. It's been in place for over 60 years and has worked really, really well. The answer to your question is that there's a minority of political religious organizations that are pushing for this, and they are in the minority, but they're very, very vocal. One of those players is the Alliance Defending Freedom. The Alliance Defending Freedom, and this is just so funny to me, that they're claiming that the IRS is persecuting churches when they have no evidence for it. But at the same time, the Alliance Defending Freedom has been leading Pulpit Freedom Sunday every year since 2008, where they encourage clergy to violate the law by endorsing or posing from the pulpit, tape themselves doing it, and to send those tapes to the IRS, which, of course, the IRS has not taken the bait. So on the one hand, they're claiming to be persecuted by the Johnson Amendment when they know full well that the Johnson Amendment isn't even really being enforced as it is, because they violate it openly and brazenly. And so they're really the head group behind it with some of their partners and allies. But I do want to add something else that actually surprised me in terms of who's involved in this fight. On the National Day of Prayer, there was a lot going on, so this was really flew under the radar. The National Day of Prayer, Trump issued his executive order on religious liberty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of attention on that. On the same day, there was a hearing that I was attending, and it was called Examining a Church's Right to Free Speech in the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And it was about the Johnson Amendment. And they had, you know, witnesses that were speaking out in support of the Free Speech Fairness Act, which would severely weaken the Johnson Amendment. There was one person on our side, Rabbi David Saperstein. And I expected to see the Family Research Council. They were there. I expected to see Alliance Defending Freedom. They were there as a witness. But then there was one witness that I was very surprised to see. And I had to look her up and see what she was all about, because I didn't understand why she was at that hearing. And she was with an organization called True the Vote. So she's not representing a church or a religious organization. That organization is under investigation for cooking numbers regarding voting. You know, basically it's an organization that's dedicated to proving this claim that there's widespread voter fraud in the United States. And their grassroots work involves sending people to the polls to report on, quote, suspicious people who may be trying to commit, you know, fraudulent voting, or who aren't citizens, and they've been in trouble for essentially harassing minorities as a result. And it's the minority ranking member on that committee, that Representative Cummings, who launched that investigation against this woman and her organization. And she's there in a hearing about free speech for churches, and really just talking about the Free Speech Fairness Act, talking about how she's been persecuted by the IRS for her work. Well, you know, I'm wondering, you know, what's the stake for her? Why is she a stakeholder in this? And the only place I could see her having a platform, I found her, you know, being talked about on Breitbart. So there's some interesting players that are involved in this kind of behind the scenes that seem to stand to benefit, even though they're not houses of worship, because they can see that if they can get the hands tied of the IRS, so that the IRS really, really is going to step back and enforce even less these rules that are meant to hold these nonprofits accountable to American taxpayers, they're going to stand to benefit. So yeah. The short answer to your question is really it's the Alliance Defending Freedom that's heading this up, but there are some murky players here too.
Well, talk about the current attempt to castrate this amendment, if you would. What's going on right now?
So right now we are trying our hardest to raise the alarm about Section 116 in the Financial Services and General Government Appropriations Bill and really prepping members of the House to make sure that they fight tooth and nail to make sure that when that comes to the floor that Section 116 is not included. And we're doing the same on the Senate side in case that passes through so that we don't see a budget that has this hidden rider in there with Section 116. That's really the focus right now. But we're also, you know, even if we defeat it, even if we see an appropriations bill without Section 116, we still have to keep an eye out for the same kind of rider to be tacked onto any sort of tax reform bill that we might see in the future. And we're also making sure that members of Congress are educated about the bills, the separate bills outside of appropriations that have been introduced, including the Free Speech Fairness Act, which has been introduced in the House as well as in the Senate. So it's a lot of meetings, getting people to make phone calls, getting people to write letters to their members of Congress, because there's a lot of lack of education among mm-hmm. members of Congress and their staff about what the Johnson Amendment even is.
Right.
And even if they're familiar with it, there's a lot of people who don't know the details about the Form 990 and how this is really going to be a campaign finance issue and as well as a constitutional issue. And so we're doing a lot of education, and we're empowering people as much as possible to make those phone calls and write letters, because this is the kind of thing that we don't want to fly under the radar.
Well, I'm really glad Secular Coalition is involved in this. Your voice is extremely important. Talk just a little bit about the Secular Coalition, because not everybody knows who you are and what you're doing.
Well, the Secular Coalition for America is a nonprofit based in D.C., and our mission is to increase the visibility and respect for the non-theistic community and non-theistic viewpoints, and to advocate for the separation of church and state as the best guarantee of freedom for all, for people of all faiths and people of no faith. And we are so proud to be working on these issues with our partners of faith, because there's just so much power in going into a member's office with Interfaith Alliance, with Baptist Joint Committee, with a number of other faith partners to say, you know, we agree on this. We stand strong together, and we believe that separation of church and state is good for everybody in this room. So that's really the kind of work we're doing. We're working with our faith partners while also making sure that people who are non-religious and non-theistic, whether they're atheists, agnostics, humanists, ethical culturalists, cultural Jews, Unitarian Universalist Humanists, there's a really wide range of non-religious people in terms of how they identify and how they organize themselves, but they all come together with each other and with their allies of faith around secular values and the idea that, you know, true religious freedom means freedom of religion and freedom from religion, so we can really truly coexist in a pluralistic society. Go to www.secular.org and take action. Fill out your information. You can make calls. You can write letters. You can tweet at your members of Congress on the Johnson Amendment and on a number of other issues that we're working on. If you want to get those action alerts straight to your inbox or even to your phone as a text message, if you like text messages, you can actually text SECULAR, SECULAR, to 52886. To get those straight to your phone. And of course, you can sign up for those alerts as well on secular.org. And, you know, we also operate on donations, so if you're feeling generous today, you can also go to secular.org/donate to support our work.
Sarah Levin is Senior Legislative Associate at the Secular Coalition for America. Sarah, you're welcome anytime on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for your help and for your support.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Interfaith Alliance President Jack Moline about another critical piece of legislation, the Franks Amendment. And up next, a pastor who writes, "Donald Trump stole my old church," the Reverend Dr. Brett Younger. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Donald Trump stole my old church. Now, I saw that headline and thought, oh, no. We can't just keep piling on the current administration. Our show is about so much more than that. But, you know, we don't spend a single second looking for anti-Trump stories to broadcast. We really don't. We focus on important stories at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, plain and simple. But I'm starting to feel like a fireman who keeps showing up to fires and finding the same guy with a book of matches there. We're responding to the fires singeing the pages of both our Constitution and our sacred texts. And if the flames are always coming from the same source, so be it. And so, back to that headline. Donald Trump stole my old church was written by a longtime friend, the Reverend Dr. Brett Younger. Brett, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to get to talk with you, Welton.
You gave the church you grew up in the benefit of Christian charity for many years. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. I tried really hard to excuse what seemed unchristian about the church in which I grew up. It's really hard to look at the people who have raised you in the faith and be honest about the ways in which they fall short of the faith to which you feel called. And so you see them discriminating against women, and you say, no, they're just defending the family. You see them acting like racist, and you say, well, they're just afraid. When they appear homophobic, you just think, well, they just don't know enough gay people. And so you continually try to defend people that you care about.
Yeah. And what about the denomination itself? What about its positions and priorities did you have to deal with?
The positions on anyone who's outside the church, and in some ways, that's kind of the crux of the issue for me. Mm-hmm. I think that the stories of the Christian faith are about listening to those outside your own community and discovering that God is at work in other places. Mm-hmm. And what I continually see is a church that has kind of a defensive mentality that doesn't want to hear any of the other voices. Mm-hmm. And so the place of God in relationship to our culture is a really divisive kind of question.
Right. You know, Brett, not long ago, I was interviewing a woman who is in the Roman Catholic Church, and she was speaking very critically about many parts of that church. And I finally came to say, well, why are you in it? Why have you stayed? And I found that's a very common question to ask to a lot of people. And I want to ask you, why was it important for you to maintain a connection with that church for so long? Because I think this is a critical issue so many of our listeners are struggling with right now.
I think you're sort of dealing with two questions constantly, and that's where you're going and with whom are you going. And many congregations focus so much on holding it together, being on the same page, we're going to do this together, that they don't take seriously the progress they need to be making and the movement they need to be a part of, especially if that movement is more outside the church than within it. And so I think finally, for me, it wasn't so much about calling out Trump. I think what Trump's done is revealed that the church of my childhood was more given to white resentment than it was to the story of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So finally, you have to say, this isn't what Christianity is. And if you're actually prophetic, you do that with a tear in your eye. To let some things go is harder than to keep hanging on to them.
I'm talking with the Reverend Dr. Brett Younger, whose recent column is headlined, Donald Trump Stole My Old Church. What did this last election do to you? What did it push some things to a breaking point that had not happened before?
Well, one of the difficulties of being a liberal Christian is that you are constantly saying, this is a matter of opinion, this is how I read the story, this is how I feel about faith. And so if you live with this respect for another person's opinion, it is increasingly difficult to say, no, that's not an opinion, that's dangerous or it's evil. An easy example is health care. Mm-hmm. You can disagree on how best to get health care to people, but if you want to deny health care to millions of people, that's not an opinion. That's evil and it's dangerous and people will die. Mm-hmm. And so this last election just made it more obvious that it's not just about a difference of opinion. It's, in some ways, there are evil forces at work.
Mm-hmm. How do you handle this? I mean, you have bound to have struggled with what do I say in the pulpit? What do I say in my writing? What do I say in the community? How have you handled that?
Well, you often find that when you speak what you think will sound like an angry or judgmental word, it is actually a word of healing for an awful lot of people. Mm-hmm. I often get responses of people who see in what I've written more of what they're feeling than what I've actually written. Mm-hmm. If they are if they are still angry at their old church, they put that on me and they talk about how their church is discriminated against them. If they're still dealing with sadness about the loss of some of their childhood approaches to faith, then they'll respond to that. There are others who think you're just late to the game if you're just now starting to move away from some of the painful truths that you were handed. I find that, for me at least, talking about these issues has led to more community than it has lost for me.
Hmm. With all of this in the background, Britt, talk a little more about the specifics you described in your column.
The approach to faith that I grew up with was narrow at multiple places. It was patriarchy, it was nostalgic, it was the enemy of the environment and science and equality. What was less obvious was, because the politics in the church were so nationalistic that they could almost act like that was business as normal, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you have an almost libertarian view of politics, then you can say the church is outside of politics because we're not helping anyone. Mm-hmm. And so when we begin to see that the church is not representing the Christian positions in terms of care for the poor or the hurting or the left out or mentally ill people, for instance, that can't be a Christian position. That can't be the position of your church.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you went back to your old church, you listened carefully, and then you got very uncomfortable. What did you hear that made you uncomfortable?
I grew up in four different small Southern Baptist churches in Mississippi, and the church I went back to was the particular church that my parents are a part of now, one that I had gone to when I was a child. But it was July the 2nd, and so there were American flags everywhere, and we sang God Bless America, and I heard, you know, we need more fire and brimstone, and we finally have a president who does what needs to be done, and we have to get rid of Obamacare right now. And I went home, and I looked up the percentage of Trump voters in that county in Mississippi, and it was 87%. Mm. And so they had bought in pretty completely. They had chosen to support a politician who promises to make the rich richer when the gospel is the opposite. They had promised not to extend hospitality to refugees when Christ's example is the opposite. They promised to support a dishonest president when truth was supposed to be at the center of what the church is doing.
So How did you stay quiet?
Well, I I have not, would be the first answer to that. I think there's a sense in which if you're going to be a part of a church and not tell the truth, then you're not really a part of that church.
Mm-hmm.
I would be really uncomfortable telling somebody whether they belonged in a congregation or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very comfortable saying, if they're not helping you be your best self, then you need to find another group of people with whom to worship. If they don't help you speak the truth as you found it, then you belong somewhere else. If you're having to hide part of yourself, then that's not what the church is supposed to be.
Did you or will you speak with the pastor of that church or with some members there that you're close to?
The more difficult one for me are my parents,
sure,
who I adore and who are in many ways magnificent exemplars of what compassion is. But somehow, good people have been more shaped by Fox News than the good news.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us are a product of our environment. What's difficult for me is admitting that for years I have argued that Christian people surrounded by an unchristian environment are still Christian at the core. What Trump has done for a lot of us is made us question what's really at the core of some of our religious institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it never was a commitment to compassion. Maybe the environment is now part of the core belief rather than the other way around.
You know, Brett, there are many, many people who deeply relate to this in addition to the host of this show. Would you say someone can do to, what would you say to someone about how to pursue a more authentic, depoliticized faith? Because I think trust becomes a critical issue at a moment like this. So how does a person who feels betrayed by their faith and by their church, how do they keep from being cynical? What should they do?
About a year ago, I moved to New York City and for the first time in my life got a spiritual director, a Franciscan monk, began meeting with him once a month. And I complained about the church and I whined about the church and things weren't what they should be and on and on and on. And he made me start reading a book about St. Francis every month.
Hmm.
And in an odd kind of way, there's this second naivete that has shown up for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to you grow up and you're told that God is love and you want to believe it, and then you become cynical and skeptical and academic and you start to argue with people and it becomes more of an exercise in futility. But on the other side of that, there can be this second naivete where you start to believe that God is love again. And that's this particular church that I'm in now, which is wonderful, has helped me get to that, to this idea that finally you can find people whose core is compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak out of the Christian tradition, but you can find those people outside of that tradition, obviously. And with those people, those can be the sisters and brothers who help you find your own way in faith.
So what have you learned about Brett Younger?
I think I do have a longing to be generous, to be generous in the way that some people were generous with me, but also to be generous in ways that I have not experienced. I remember reading a piece that you wrote, Welton, years ago, where you said, "My experience of the church has never been as good as the way I imagined the church." And getting in touch with that longing for that hopefulness that we can be more true to the best parts of our faith, as I get older, that gets more and more important to me, and a lot of the rest of it is less important.
Mm. The Reverend Dr. Brett Younger is Senior Minister of Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, New York. He's a graduate of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Younger is the author of numerous books, including Time for Supper, Invitations to Christ's Table, and Who Moved My Pulpit? We'll link to his Baptist News Global article, Donald Trump Stole My Old Church, from stateofbelief.com. And I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Welton. I've enjoyed talking with you.
I always feel a tinge of guilt when I welcome this next guest to State of Belief Radio, because I know how much harder his job as president of Interfaith Alliance is today than any of us could have anticipated. But we're lucky to have him in that position. And so I'm pleased to welcome Rabbi Jack Moline back to the show. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Welton.
When you talk to folks around the country, are you hearing the same things as you're hearing in the nation's capital?
Well, yes and no. There still remains a significant divide in the country, and there are lots of people who are working very hard to defend the decision they made to vote for President Trump. In the same way, we heard a lot of people working very hard to defend their vote for President Obama in the early days of his administration. The difference here is that I'm hearing supporters of the president sort of shrug at the compromises that we see on the horizon of our civil and religious liberties, and that concerns me a lot. Mm-hmm. They're of the opinion that it's just something that's necessary at this moment in time because of the exigencies that we address in the world we live in. And my response to them was, is, and remains that our civil and moral values are only as strong when they protect the most vulnerable and marginal members of our society.
Jack, I know a big priority for Interfaith Alliance right now is the Franks Amendment. Tell our listeners what that is, please.
So this is the worst idea you never heard of. Trent Franks, who is a member of Congress from Arizona, introduced an amendment to the Defense Appropriation Bill, which would have not only authorized but mandated the Secretary of Defense to conduct two concurrent strategic assessments, as the proposal says, of the use of violent or unorthodox Islamic religious doctrine to support extremist or terrorist messaging. In other words, he sought to authorize the government to investigate the sacred teachings of Islam with an eye to determining whether they're being used to promote terrorism and extremism. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, a violation of everything that is sacred in the First Amendment. And it was defeated. I'm happy to tell you that it is not going to come for a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives. But it was defeated by 9 votes. 208 out of 235 members of Congress voted for this amendment. 217 voted against it. Okay. And actually, the only person who had an excuse for abstaining is Representative Scalise from Louisiana, to whom we wish a speedy recovery. But he was in the hospital. I don't know why 5 people abstained from this. It is, to quote the Declaration of Independence, self-evident what a bad idea this is.
Well, my next question was going to be, where does this kind of misguided legislation come from? Obviously, it comes from a lot of places.
It certainly comes from the bad information that a lot of Americans, including apparently our elected representatives, have about the nature of Islam and the nature of religious belief. It comes from an ignorance of the role that any faith tradition plays in the lives of extremists. And those faith traditions are not just Islam. They include every faith tradition on earth. We've had extremism in the name of Christianity, in the name of Judaism, in the name of Buddhism. You can name it, and you will find that every religious tradition has its outliers who pervert the message of love and acceptance that is part of almost every religious tradition, certainly Islam. And it comes from a desire to blame and to divert so that we don't have to address the genuine internal issues that we as a people need to address.
Give our listeners a sense of the harm this kind of policy would cause, please.
Can you imagine being visited by either a civilian or worse, a member of the military in uniform in your home or your place of worship, and being interrogated about the sacred teachings of your tradition by someone unfamiliar with them? I mean, imagine if you were a Christian, as allegedly you are, Welton, mm-hmm. and someone came to your house and said, "Look, I understand that that the teachings of Christianity, the words of Jesus, instruct you that if your enemy strikes you on one cheek, you should turn the other cheek. Does that mean that you condone domestic violence?" Mm. You know, what kind of nonsense would that be? Suppose that someone came to me to talk about our sacred rite of circumcision and said, "Does this mean that you promote child abuse because an unconsenting minor is being subjected to elective surgery?" Nonsense. Mm. And that's what would be the result of an amendment like this to a defense appropriation bill. It would mandate the interrogation of innocent American citizens about their Muslim faith.
With that many supportive votes for that kind of amendment, should we expect to see it back in some form? And what is Interfaith Alliance doing about that?
Well, Congressman Franks is notorious for promoting ideas like this. This is not the first time that he has made a representation about Islam or other matters for that matter, but about Islam in particular. So I think it's a pretty fair bet that if he has another idea, we will see him put it forward. So, yes, I think we can expect it, and I think we can expect other such offensive measures to come forth. What concerns me is not Trent Franks, to be honest with you. What concerns me is the 207 other members of Congress who voted for this, which reveals an alarming lack of knowledge and support for the Constitution that they swore to uphold when they entered office.
What else is on the front burner at the Alliance?
We continue to watch very, very carefully the treatment of the LGBTQ community in the United States. So much distraction is happening because of these high-profile conversations about foreign interference in American elections and the ethics of people who are in high office, that we are not paying close attention to the fact that the Attorney General has announced that he will be providing guidance on the enforcement of previously understood restrictions on defending discrimination in the name of deeply held personal religious conviction. And I think what we're going to see, especially since the Supreme Court has agreed to take a case on the question of a commercial business refusing service to a lesbian couple, I think what we're going to see now is lots of activism in certain parts of the country, of individual citizens challenging the notion that all men and women are created equal in this country.
Good grief. In watching all that's been going on in the healthcare conversation, are you seeing anything that has direct relevance to what you and all of us are going to be experiencing in relation to religious freedom?
We're going to be looking at people who have very strong feelings about reproductive health care, mm-hmm. who will be attempting to continue the circumvention of the mandates of the Affordable Care Act.
Sure.
And I think that's part of it. But I think that a moment of truth is coming for people who pronounce themselves to be compassionate and loving when they look at proposals to roll back health care for the very people who need it the most. I mean, we heard Britt Hume on Fox News suggest that providing health care to people with pre-existing conditions is somehow un-American because, I don't know, they're getting a free ride. I don't know what it is. But if someone like, not to sort of exploit him here, if someone like Steve Scalise, who suffered an injury that no individual should have to undergo, could not count on health care as a result of that injury now, what does that say about the compassion, the love, and the healing, literally and figuratively, that our faith traditions provide in this country?
Before we get off, tell our listeners how they can get involved in the work of Interfaith Alliance and how much money they need to send today.
The answer to that question is it's July, and July for every nonprofit, except perhaps the Foundation for Free Ice Cream Cones. Every nonprofit suffers at this time of the year because people are on vacation, and Congress is about to go on recess, and the news is filled with swimming pools and weather reports. We right now can use the contributions of our supporters and our members more than ever. If we can secure our efforts through this summer, the fall promises to be a remarkably productive time for us. We have been blessed with two wonderful interns this summer. We have a legal intern coming in the fall, and our staff continues to work their backsides off on behalf of the organization, the values we stand for. Of course, the real action in religious freedom happens in your neighborhood. So if there's something going on that needs our attention, please let us know in the D.C. office. And if there are like-minded people in your community, we'd be happy to help you organize them into local representatives of Interfaith Alliance.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true faith and freedom. Jack, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
And Weldon, when we talk in December, let's remember these dog days of summer.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share that with that person. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You heard Jack Moline talking about the incredibly important work the Alliance is doing to defend true faith and freedom at a critical moment in our history. It is incredibly important that you join the ranks of Interfaith Alliance members today. Right now. Do it right now. Go to interfaithalliance.org. Become a member. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.